This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. My name is Jim Santel. I'm sitting in for Maggie today in this, the second hour of our afternoon broadcast. I am joined in the Civic Media studios by my outstanding producer, Jess, and together at the number 855-752-4842, 855-752-4842, you can be a part of our discussion, asking questions, raising issues in connection with our syllabus this afternoon. Lots of justice-related things, lots of things that go to the issues about process, how we do cases, how investigations are pursued, and how grand juries work as well. Always focusing upon what we know to be true and those things that are not. Promised at the start of our broadcast this afternoon that we would also involve you in that discussion. Wanted specifically to identify and tell Steve from Milwaukee that we appreciate very much his comment. He says, prosecuting a former president for election fraud and violating national security is a sign of a functioning government. Indeed, it is, Steve. And again, we know that the simple return of a grand jury indictment does not mean that that particular individual, in this case, Donald Trump, is guilty. That's a determination made, if at all, by a trial jury that has to be unanimous in our system, that has to be beyond a reasonable doubt. That's after the presentation of evidence. And only after that is an individual like Donald Trump adjudged a felon or a misdemeanant, depending upon the charges against him or others. We know that that's exactly what happened in Manhattan, that case in front of Judge Juan Merchan, going to hearings in mid-September related to whether the judge will recuse himself, whether he will find that there were some immunities that attached, almost certainly will dismiss those petitions by the defense, and then proceed to sentencing, which is also a part of the very system, the functioning government, the functioning democracy that Steve talks about in his comment to us here at Civic Media. Appreciate that very much. Steve goes on to say, but letting him off the hook is authoritarianism, especially when he has been a fraud and a cheat his entire life. And again, that is a part of our system, right? It's premised upon the notion that no one is above the law. No one should be given immunity, which is the reason why that Supreme Court case is so very troubling, not only in its particulars with respect to Donald Trump, but changing the Constitution about who our president is. And ultimately, as Steve's good point underscores, the reason for our criminal justice system is, yes, to hold people accountable, to ensure that the crimes committed against the norms and the standards of our community are addressed, and that in those instances where the crimes have been proven by the prosecution beyond a reasonable doubt, there are consequences for those. And all that is called deterrence. That's also implicit in what Steve has written to us here at Civic Media. Individual deterrence. Steve talks about the deterrence that he plainly wants to see with respect to Donald Trump. He describes him as a fraud and a cheat. You deter the individual from engaging in that kind of fraudulent cheating activity, stopping the specific person. That's called specific deterrence. That is accomplished by entering a judgment and a sentence, not only of a criminal conviction, but in many cases, imposing a term of imprisonment, detaining an individual, sending the message that your behavior has got to stop. That's individual deterrence, that's specific deterrence. And then there's a thing called general deterrence, which is also implicit, I would say, Steve, in your comments to us this afternoon. And that is this notion that the very fact that prosecutors prosecute, whether it's in Arizona or in Georgia or in the District of Columbia, other places around the country, also sends messages to all of us that if you engage in the similar kind of conduct in another state, here in Wisconsin, other places around our great union, you too could suffer the same consequences. And those consequences could be charging by a prosecutor, charging by a federal or a state grand jury. The requirement then that you appear in a trial court to answer those charges, due process given to you, equal protection of the laws. That's our aspiration in those processes. Defendants assumed innocent until proven guilty. All of those fundamental standards attached to you at the time that you are charged. But the deterrence is also to the larger community. And the message is, don't do this same kind of thing, or you too will suffer the same kinds of consequences. That is called general deterrence. And that's the message that these prosecutions, whether they are state or federal, send to everyone who is involved in this conspiracy to undermine the 2020 election, the fake electors, sending a message as we go into 2024 that if you do the same thing this time around, or if others are out there thinking of doing that same kind of thing, you too could suffer the same kind of consequence. All of that, a part of our purpose in doing prosecution. And plainly animating the decisions by prosecutors as they confer with grand juries, as they confer with investigators, to determine not only how a crime was committed, what happened, under what circumstances, but what the impact of the prosecution will be as to the specific defendant, the particular people who are on the receiving end of those charges, and also the broader community. And that broader community, that interest that Steve is implicitly conveying to us, that cannot be overstated. It is the sending the notion, the message to our community that the prosecution, the government, does in fact have the best interests of the community at mind, and that people who engage in violations of our laws will be brought to justice. That not only deters other people from engaging the same conduct, but also gives satisfaction and some relief, some sense of confidence in government, that government is indeed protecting the interests of the constituents that it's there to serve. All of that a part of our criminal justice system, all of that a part of our process by which we bring people to the bar of justice. All of that also a part of our criminal justice system. We know as well that there is a civil department, mechanisms in prosecution offices, in U.S. attorneys' offices around the country. There are also civil divisions. At Maine Justice in Washington, D.C., there is an entire civil division that is responsible for handling cases not only there in Washington, D.C., but also cases around the nation. So we think about those cases as well. Among those civil cases are cases involving our environment, cases brought by a particular division inside the Department of Justice called the Environment and Natural Resources Division, frequently works with many federal agencies in addressing civilly, and yes, also sometimes criminally, those people who would pollute our air, our land, our water, otherwise engage in violations of the laws of our federal government that are designed to protect our safety and security when it comes to the environment. And so we've got evidence of the civil activity, not only of this administration, of the Biden administration, of the Merrick Garland administration at Maine Justice, and yes, indeed, in other districts around the country, by virtue of another announcement made by the Department of Justice. This one goes back a few weeks, but it's important to underscore, somewhat overtaken by other events at the time. In mid-July, the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, announced a major Clean Air Act disposition, a settlement involving allegations of the release of methane gases into the North Dakota air. Marathon Oil is the target, is the subject, the identified perpetrator of these Clean Air Act violations. What did the Department of Justice do as a part of this investigation of what Marathon Oil did in North Dakota? And how did this case get resolved by the Department of Justice, again, working with U.S. attorneys' offices, but at this ENRD group inside Maine Justice? Marathon Oil agreed in mid-July to spend $241.5 million to resolve these federal allegations of violations of the Clean Air Act, unlawfully emitting methane. And as you know, that's a planet-warming greenhouse gas, and other pollutants from where? From oil and gas facilities located principally in North Dakota. And so you've got Maine Justice, this ENRD division, also working with the U.S. Attorney's Office in North Dakota, also working with the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and other agencies, likely also involving state agencies. We know that states also have similar entities that are out there protecting our environment, our land, our air, our water. They also work cooperatively on a routine basis with our federal authorities in identifying those people who pollute and bringing them to justice, again, for two clearly important purposes. One, to stop the specific event from happening again. That's the specific deterrence that we talked about just a moment or so ago. And then there's the general deterrence. If there are others who would also pollute our air or our land and our water, they should also know that there will be consequences for that. Hopefully, this kind of a civil disposition would discourage them from doing the same kind of thing, prompting them to comply with the requirements of federal law. So what in particular does this settlement with Marathon Oil of mid-July, what does it accomplish? Well, under the proposed settlement, again announced by the Department of Justice, the oil and gas producer, it's again Marathon Oil, it's based in Houston, would pay a $64.5 million civil penalty. Again, that's under the federal statutes. It simply says we're penalizing you for doing this very bad thing. The federal government said it was the largest ever fined for alleged violations of the Clean Air Act. The Clean Air Act, as you know, passed by the United States Congress, compromised in many ways by the United States Supreme Court in at least one, if not two, cases that denigrate the capacity of the Department of Justice to enforce it. But the violations of the Clean Air Act that intended by the Congress to provide a cleaner environment for all of us to live here on the face of this planet. And the identification of Marathon Oil as the principal perpetrator at a stationary infrastructure there in North Dakota. Marathon also agrees, in addition to the $64.5 million civil penalty, which again is just punishment for doing what they did, also agree to spend $177 million to reduce future emissions in North Dakota. And those include one on the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, where the EPA said the company had violated permitting requirements and other rules in recent years. All of that, a part of this disposition that the civil litigators and the civil investigators have accomplished. As we continue here on the Maggie Dawn Show, more about this significant Clean Air Act disposition affected by the Department of Justice on behalf of all of us who are the constituents of this administration and of the Department of Justice generally. Stay with us for more of that discussion. This is the Maggie Dawn Show on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. My name is Jim Santel, sitting in for Maggie this afternoon in this, the second hour of our broadcast, also involving you, questions, inquiries, comments about our review of some of the major news stories in the areas of justice, but also going back and covering some things that happened in the past month or two, somewhat overtaken by other news stories, but nonetheless important in their own right. Also explaining along the way how this process works. And that includes the work of the U.S. Department of Justice in the Environmental and Natural Resource Division, accomplishing a major settlement to the benefit of all of us, remedying not only what has happened in the past with respect to clean air in and about North Dakota, but also ensuring future protections. And so this major settlement announced in mid-July contemplates that Marathon Oil also spends $177 million to reduce future emissions, to do things in the future to ensure that this doesn't happen again, and significantly including some of those emissions on Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, where the EPA once again said that the permitting requirements and other rules had been violated. So what is this case ultimately all about? The Justice Department, who brought this lawsuit, this civil lawsuit, not a criminal case, civil lawsuit on behalf of the EPA, said Marathon had basically failed to obtain those necessary permits to comply with some of the emissions regulations that the EPA has put into place by virtue of the commission given to it by the legislature to act in this area. Dozens of oil and gas production facilities in North Dakota apparently not getting the necessary permits, complying with the emissions regulations that are established for the benefit of you and me. Marathon has agreed to release to limit the releases of volatile organic compounds as a part of the remedies in this settlement. That's a class of pollutants that, according to the documents released by the Department of Justice, cause harm to humans and wildlife. And they also agreed, the folks at Marathon also agreed, to install equipment that would monitor flaring, F-L-A-R-I-N-G, flaring, this practice of burning natural gas that energy companies cannot easily dispose of or pipe to where it's needed. We probably have seen some of that in the landscapes of America. Installing equipment that would monitor that process. The company, again, as a part of the remedial aspect of this case, also said it would perform more frequent inspections, reviews of what it's doing, and additional preventive maintenance. All those kinds of things to address the future and to ensure that these kinds of things that the EPA, the Environmental and Natural Resources Division, identified would not happen again. Marathon also agreed, very significantly, to have an independent auditor review its permit applications. Now, what is that all about? Often the case that the Department of Justice, including this environmental unit inside the Department of Justice, makes these findings and in the end wants to ensure that as the company, which has paid a fine, which is committing to do all these things to ensure that in the future the same kinds of faults don't happen again, but to ensure that that happens on a regular basis, the establishment of an auditor who is there to review the permit applications to ensure compliance going forward. Somebody who is not on the employ of Marathon Oil or the particular identified entity that's engaging in the bad conduct, but who can in fact report back to the Department of Justice, can in fact make public reports about the kinds of things that are being done in these permit applications. No small enforcement aspect, also a part of this settlement. The Marathon Oil Company itself said this. It said findings from such inspections, monitoring, and auditing activities may result in decisions to temporarily shut in or reduce production from certain wells and facilities. They are embracing this notion of review of permit applications by saying that when the results of that monitoring, that auditing activity come clear, that they in fact may respond to those things by temporarily shutting down some production there in North Dakota. Taking all of this together, the disposition in this major settlement, these new investments would, over 5 years, reduce emissions there in North Dakota, equivalent to taking about 487,000 cars off the road. That's an estimate given by EPA and also embraced by Marathon Oil. No small thing. Again, these are not simply lawyers putting together terms and conditions, but consulting the experts inside the EPA, certainly the experts at Marathon Oil themselves, and determining what the impact of this kind of monitoring and these new changes in the limitations of releases of these organic compounds, what is the impact of that? The equivalent of 487,000 cars being taken off the road. No small thing. Again, all of that a part of the Biden administration, the Merrick Garland administration, the work of the U.S. Attorney's Office there in North Dakota, and of prosecutors in the civil side, of Marathon Oil itself. The lawyers there, the leadership of Marathon Oil, had decided to agree to this as a part of its being a good citizen, a good entity in our nation, and going ahead to do this on behalf of the people of our nation. Marathon recently also agreed to be acquired by its larger rival, ConocoPhillips. That's part of a trend, as you probably know, of consolidation inside many industries, including the oil industry. The stock deal, that particular stock deal, was announced way back in May, placed a valuation of Marathon Oil at about $17 billion, not including some debts. And the two companies, again, merging here, being acquired here, said at the time of this announcement, this stock announcement, that they expected to complete the transaction in the fourth quarter of this year. Now, the proposed settlement that I'm discussing and presenting here from about a month or so ago is not quite done. Part of our process here in determining whether or not it's in the best interests of the government, best interests of Marathon Oil, but most importantly, the best interests of all of us is what's called the comment period, a public comment period. And what happens is that this particular settlement like other settlements of this kind coming out of the Department of Justice, are posted for your consumption, for your review. Federal Register, other mechanisms online, you can review all of this. It's in great detail. And you can provide public comments about whether that this is wise or not. You can comment about particular things, overall comments about this being good, this being bad, this being somewhere in between. And the reason for that as a part of our administrative process is that in the end, those comments are taken into consideration as the parties, indeed the Department of Justice itself, determines whether or not to go ahead. And sometimes as a result of those good and thoughtful public comments that are out there in the public domain, there are changes that are made to the terms and conditions. And so while it is anticipated that these basic structures, the huge amount of money, $241.5 million, $64 million in civil penalties, $177 million in remedies to reduce future emissions, all of that's in place, but also subject now to your comments as this deal goes forward to bring not only this particular case to a resolution, but also to ensure that North Dakota and other places in America are more clean and more consistent with our Clean Act standards. As we continue here on the Maggie Dawn Show, more coming out of the Department of Justice and on behalf of all of us here in the state of Wisconsin and the United States of America. Stay with us for all of that. This is the Maggie Dawn Show. My name is Jim Santel, sitting in for Maggie Dawn in this, our second hour of our afternoon broadcast, joined in the studios of Civic Media by my outstanding producer, Jess. And together, we're taking your phone calls, as always, at 855-752-4842. Jess also reminds me that you can send us a note, a comment, an inquiry about any of the topics that we're discussing this afternoon by going into the Civic Media app and communicating with us through that method. Delighted, as always, to have your comments, your questions in particular about the subject matter. We're covering a lot of ground this afternoon and focusing a lot upon the work of the Department of Justice, things that we know are reliable because they're in the public domain, not simply because the Department of Justice tells us about them, but they're also in the court system and accessible by all of us in a system that is transparent and is accessible to us as we understand what's going on in our nation. Speaking this afternoon a lot about, for example, the criminal work that the Department of Justice does at Main Justice in Washington, D.C., involving, for example, these major charges against this Pakistani man who was in an alleged plot to kill United States leaders, thwarted by the outstanding work of the FBI who stopped this from happening, charging this fellow with these crimes under our federal criminal code, bringing him to justice, stopping him from doing this, deterring him, presumably deterring others who might engage in the same kind of conduct. Also talking about the civil work of the Department of Justice, this case involving Marathon Oil, deciding to pay almost $242 million to settle some major Clean Act violations coming out of North Dakota, and also to remedy the results of its past bad behavior in this area by putting together all sorts of mechanisms to limit releases of organic compounds and methane, the greenhouse gases that are polluting the air in and around North Dakota, a situation where you can comment on the results of that. The Department of Justice is also, of course, in U.S. Attorney's offices, not just in North Dakota, not just here in Wisconsin, not just out in the District of Columbia, but in states throughout the nation. There are 93 different districts in 50 states and territories as well. Let's talk about another one of these cases prosecuted by the Department of Justice to send a message of deterrence, specific deterrence as to an individual, but also general deterrence as to other people who might engage in the same kind of conduct. A former California public school official, a public school official out in California, Orange County, who embezzled more than $16 million from a school district, is now facing justice as a result of an investigation, almost certainly a cooperative effort as a result of local and state and federal investigation of what he had done. He used the money to fund a very lavish lifestyle, according to all the records, all the representations made once again in court, in the public domain, reliable information, and was sentenced to nearly 6 years in prison just in the past several weeks. 6 years in prison for engaging in that embezzlement activity, deterring him, plainly, from ever doing this again, but also sending the message to other people who might be engaging in similar embezzlement, big, small, in between, doing the same kind of thing. Federal judge in Orange County, which is the Central District of California, that's the federal district in California, where this case was presented, prosecuted to a grand jury, returned a grand jury indictment finding probable cause to believe that this particular individual had indeed used his position in the Orange County school system, the school district there, to embezzle money. Federal judge in July sentenced a fellow named Jorge Armando Contreras. He's 53 years old. He worked for the Magnolia School District in Orange County, right there in the Central District of California, and sentenced once again to 70 months in federal prison. Ordered him to pay $16,694,942 in restitution, approximately $17 million, almost exactly the amount that he stole during the course of his embezzlement. The defendant here, Mr. Contreras, pleaded guilty in March to that indictment returned by the grand jury. One count of embezzlement was his plea. He pled to theft. He pled to intentional misapplication of funds from an organization receiving federal funds. And there, once again, is an important teaching point coming out of this. That's the hook. That's the connection to the federal system. Probably this case could have been prosecuted as well by state authorities based upon violations of California law. Decision made certainly in cooperation between state and federal investigators to go federal, as sometimes people say. Why? For two reasons. One is a huge amount of money here, bringing it within the prosecution guidelines, if you will, of the U.S. Attorney's Office there in Central California. But also because of this connection to federal funds. The district plainly receiving those federal funds, therefore, by virtue of the embezzlement that Mr. Contreras engaged in, a federal loss, a federal compromise in the government operation of those funds given to that school district in Orange County. Funding this luxurious lifestyle, again, based upon representations in court. The U.S. Attorney for the Central District of California sent a statement related to this disposition, this criminal case involving this school district leader there, said that instead of using his job at a public school district to help socioeconomically disadvantaged children, Mr. Contreras had embezzled millions of dollars in a scheme that fraudulently created for him a life of opulence. And what is that all about? Well, apparently, according to the, again, evidence presented in trial, thus reliable reporting, reliable information, he used the money to buy a range of luxurious products like Louis Vuitton bags, $2,000 tequila bottles, about $7.7 million in personal and real property traced to the scheme has in fact been seized. Took that money and acquired personal and real properties in the amount of almost $8 million. As a result of what's called the forfeiture proceedings in federal court, all of those properties, those ill-gotten gains, as they are sometimes described, all of those seized, taken from him, and returned ultimately to the coffers of the federal government, provided basically to the victims of this crime, in this case, the citizens of America, who through their tax dollars had funded these education funds that went to this Orange County school district, squandered by Mr. Contreras as a part of his fraud. Court documents specifically showed that his scheme, this embezzlement scheme, began in 2016, lasted until July of 2023, a long period of time for any scheme like this to go on, apparently undetected for a lot of that. But during that period, he worked as the director and the senior director of fiscal services at the school district, plainly giving him access to the information that he was using to engage in this kind of embezzlement. It serves students from preschool through sixth grade in Anaheim and Stanton. Cities about 25 miles or so. Those are southeast of Los Angeles. About 81% of those students classify as socioeconomically disadvantaged. And that, once again, is the tragedy of this case, right? It is government monies, your tax dollars being sent to this school district to provide disadvantaged, socioeconomically disadvantaged students in this district with the support to get a good education. This defendant taking those monies, embezzling them to his own aggrandizement. He did, in fact, have access to several school districts' bank accounts as a part of his role in this fiscal services assignment, and also the student body's bank account, according to court records provided during the course of this prosecution, the plea agreement back in May, and now the sentencing in July. Prosecutors, again, the U.S. Attorney's Office there, said that he would write checks to MSD and receive the required signatures from other officials and then increase the amounts on the checks before depositing them into his personal bank account. That kind of event, that kind of activity, fairly easily traced, candidly, by the FBI, certainly by school officials, as they, I suspect, began to get very suspicious about what was going on here. But nonetheless, identified by the FBI and presented as a part of the charges against him to the grand jury, presented to the court in support of the judge taking the plea in this case and ultimately sentencing Mr. Contreras to that sentence. As a part of this scheme that is described again in the sentencing proceeding, Contreras apparently gave the school district falsified bank records and deposited more than 250 checks into his personal bank account. Again, all of that a part of the investigation completed by the FBI. Between 2009 and 2022, his annual salary increased from about $50,000 a year to about $220,000. Now, the records of this case, however, also indicate that the purchases he was making, those kinds of lavish lifestyle things he was engaging in, far exceeded that salary amount, even at the level of $220,000. Nothing that he could afford under that kind of salary. He drove a BMW X5. He bought a new $1.5 million home in Yorba Linda. He wore designer clothes, shoes. He owned 57 luxury designer bags and pieces of high-end jewelry by David Yurman. All those kinds of things, they come out during the course of the investigation. They're presented to the grand jury, presented now in open court to explain what it is that Contreras did with this money and also describe once again his intent. As we described before, the importance of establishing for the judge who is responsible for ensuring that the defendant's plea is knowing, it's willing, that there is a factual basis, a predicate for doing it, can't simply take a plea if indeed there's not intent that's shown and the facts themselves do not support the conviction. All of this presented not only the scheme to defraud, the scheme to embezzle, the way he did this with his checks, the embezzlement that resulted in these monies going into his personal bank accounts, but also the results of that, his lavish lifestyle, a demonstration, a very clear illustration to the judge and to others there in the court that he was benefiting wildly from his embezzlement. He also wired about $150,000 to multiple banks in Mexico. In one of the notes for that transfer, Contreras wrote, building home. In another, he wrote, construction doors, stairs, and window. That's a part of plainly the construction that he was engaging in at his own home, based upon his use of the monies coming from that school district. He hid his wealth in part, not indefinitely plainly, but in part through a production company he owned called JC Productions, which he advertised on an Instagram as staging the best musical productions and live events known to the area. So a little bit of attempt to hide all of this, but in the end, plainly discovered, certainly by the school district, certainly by local authorities, and ultimately by the FBI, that returns all of this information to the prosecutors in the Central District of California. They present it to a federal grand jury. They return an indictment, and then the sentencing
proceeds in July. 70 months in federal prison and a requirement to pay about $16 million in restitution to make whole the victims. Who are the victims? It's the Department of Education. It's you and me. That's where these monies came from. That's where these monies, if indeed, based upon the seizures of the properties that he got and other mechanisms to collect on that criminal judgment now imposed upon Jorge Armando Contreras, based upon all of that, trying to make the victims in this case whole. Unclear whether that $16.7 million amount, that amount of the fraud, will ever be recouped in its entirety, but significant that huge seizures being made to try to chip away at that and return those monies once again as a part of the criminal justice system. A good illustration, once again, of what criminal prosecution, this time at the federal system, inside the Department of Justice can accomplish. Not only identifying a perpetrator of this kind of fraud, but also ensuring that the people of America are made whole. The deterrence of the individual and deterrence of other people, whether they are in school districts, anybody who is engaging in transactions involving federal monies, who might decide to embezzle them to his own credit, her own credit, her own benefit, all of that, the subject of the messaging coming out of the Central District of California upon the conviction and the sentencing of Contreras to 70 months in federal prison. As we continue our discussion here in the final segment of our afternoon broadcast, more on what the Department of Justice does on behalf of the people of our nation. This is the Maggie Dawn Show. My name is Jim Santel. Delighted, honored to be with you in this, the final segment of our afternoon broadcast. As I do so, want to thank very much the leadership of Civic Media for affording me this opportunity today and in previous days to come into your lives, your homes, your businesses, and talk about these issues. Also want to thank my terrific producers, Jess, of course, and Brian. I want to thank Maggie Dawn in particular for affording me this opportunity to engage with you in these discussions about what your government does, especially focusing upon the U.S. Department of Justice. A story from late June that did, in fact, get a lot of coverage that also warrants attention as we think about the place of America on a world basis and also about the role that the Department of Justice plays in bringing people to justice and doing things that are fair and decent, and accomplish not only resolutions, but also bring cases to ends that need to be brought to an end. And I'm talking about Julian Assange. Late June of this year, Julian Assange, ultimately, the case against him brought to a conclusion based upon the longstanding work of the Department of Justice, the Counterterrorism Division of the Justice Department in particular, in ultimately bringing a case to resolution, to settlement. What had happened in this particular case, you recall well, 2019, once again, a federal grand jury had indicted Julian Assange on 18 counts related to WikiLeaks dissemination of a very, very broad array, all kinds of national security documents. Those included, again, according to the charges in this case, a treasure trove, if you will, of materials sent to the organization by Chelsea Manning. Remember Chelsea Manning, a former U.S. intelligence analyst who handed over that information about military planning and operations nearly a decade earlier. Lots and lots of disagreement in the public domain about what Assange had done there. This, lots of people outside of the particular focus of the case and even those focusing on it said that this was an action that Assange undertook pursuant to First Amendment rights to disclose these kinds of things. U.S. officials, of course, took strong exception to that view, arguing that Assange's actions went far beyond just news gathering under the First Amendment, putting at risk national security. The material furnished, they said, by Ms. Manning endangered the lives of service members and Iraqis who work with the military, made it much harder, they maintained,
for the country to counter external threats. No small consequence, again, according to the government, according to the Department of Justice. All of this prosecuted. You know well what happened here. Julian Assange in hiding, if you will, for a long period of time, not just in America, eventually makes his way, of course, overseas, and makes his way, as you know, ultimately in the disposition of this case to the Northern Mariana Islands. It's one of our territories. It is subject to federal jurisdiction. And according to the disposition documents filed in this case, filed in the federal judicial offices there, Julian Assange, again, in late June, appears at that time, and he agrees to plead guilty to a single felony count of illegally obtaining and disclosing these national security materials in exchange for what? In exchange for his release from where he was most recently imprisoned, in a British prison. That's where he fled to, ending his long and, frankly, a long-standing, fairly bitter standoff with the United States of America. Lots and lots of diplomatic engagements here, lots of things back and forth, lots of negotiations involving foreign officials, involving our Department of Justice, ultimately the Biden administration with the Department of Justice agreeing that 5 years in prison in Britain is sufficient to respond to his conduct. And so, when Julian Assange appeared in front of the federal district court judge in the Northern Marianas Islands, what happened was he pleaded guilty to that count. He is a convicted felon. And in exchange for that, the government agreed that the 5-year term that he had served, the 5 years imprisonment, was a sufficient penalty for him, deterred him enough already, and did not require any further term of imprisonment. And so, in the wake of all of that, in the wake of his appearing there in the federal district court, the Prime Minister of Australia suggested to the U.S. prosecutors that all this needed to be concluded and agreed that they were open to a rapid resolution of this. Top officials accepted all of this, and ultimately, with no additional prison time, Julian Assange served, again, this 5-year term of imprisonment and returned to his home in Australia, all as a result of the disposition of this case negotiated after many years of negotiations with him, with his attorneys, with countries overseas, with Great Britain, with Australia, with our president, and indeed with the Department of Justice as well. All of this, a part of the execution of justice once again. And in videos posted after all this happened, Assange himself said that while these developments happened very quickly, he said, "This period of our lives, I am confident now, has come to an end." His wife also added, "What starts now with Julian's freedom is a new chapter. And so it brings to conclusion," which is also an important aspect for criminal prosecution, brings to a conclusion a case that plainly was stymied. The custodial situation that Julian Assange found himself in this Britain prison for many years. He was plainly in an embassy over there for a long period of time. Lots of diplomatic standoffs going on while this case was pending here. Ultimately resolved by all the parties coming together and saying it is in the interest of justice now. His having served for 5 years in this British jail, that is sufficient to meet the ends of justice. That is the punishment. That's the deterrence. And that's also the deterrent message, frankly, that should go out to other people who might engage in the same kinds of things. Assange, of course, to the very end here, maintaining that what he was doing was a part of his constitutional right to engage in this kind of disclosure in the public domain. The debate of that continues. But today, Julian Assange in Australia, a free man in the wake of the disposition of this long-standing case pending in the United States Department of Justice. My name is Jim Santel. In addition to appearing occasionally on this broadcast, The Maggie Dawn Show, I also have a broadcast that appears and occurs on Saturday morning. It is called Amicus Law Review. I invite you to join me from 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock on Saturday mornings to talk about all these kinds of things as we review issues in the areas of law and justice and the aspiration for justice. This Saturday, a lot of focus on international rule of law issues here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Join me then. Have a good rest of the week, everybody. Take care.